Hello, this is Real Estate Insights, the podcast from Savills that casts its eye over all parts of the property world. And to that end, it's time for our annual cross-sector forecasts, in which we will, as usual, be delving into the future of the commercial, rural and residential markets.
The mortgage markets have repaired more quickly than we anticipated. That's brought fixed rate mortgage costs down, a bit more stability in those, and that's fed through into the market a bit more quickly, I think, than any of us would have anticipated.
We're probably seeing a little bit of an upturn in land being supplied to the market in comparison to the first quarter of 2023. In terms of land values, they've probably stood on from the back end of 2023 into the first quarter of 2024.
All of our data suggests that actually the hit of post-COVID agile working to offices has been relatively minimal. And actually, there's such a shortage of good quality space, rents are going up.
I'm Guy Ruddle, and after a couple of years away from this annual podfest, we've dragged the heads of the research team from each sector back, kicking and screaming into the studio. So let's introduce them. Lucien Cook, you'll remember, leads the residential research team. Lucien, welcome back. You've got quite a big team in Savills.
Yeah, I mean, it's reasonable. And I guess that is, we've got fingers in lots of pies within the residential sector. So I suppose lots of people just think of us about for our sort of residential agency business at the top end of the market. But actually, my team covers everything from affordable housing through to residential development, through to development land, you know, through to the stuff that perhaps we're more closely associated with.
And new to the podcast is Kelly Hewson-Fisher, who is head of the rural research team. Kelly, welcome to Real Estate Insights. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you come from a farming background yourself, don't you?
I do. It's really lovely, actually. I actually live in the village where my parents started their farming enterprise in 1972. I grew up on a dairy farm in Lincolnshire. We then moved to Yorkshire and we ended up on an arable and sheep farm in Scotland. And then we came back down to Lincolnshire.
Well, haven't you got backstories like that, you two?
Yes, I have. I'm the son of a dairy farmer from Somerset.
So, oh, Lucien.
So Kelly and I have quite a bit in common, albeit in different parts of the country.
Oh, well, there you are. And Matt Oakley is, of course, in charge of the UK and European commercial research team. Did you grow up on a farm, Matt?
No, and I only bought my first pair of waterproof boots in the last 2 months.
And really?
Really.
Oh, and how long have you been doing the commercial research job?
30 plus years in the industry now.
Really? That's amazing. Right, so let's get into this. There's sort of lots of things I want to cover today. There's you know, what you think is going to happen this year in each area, your top tips for each area, maybe look at the sort of, you know, the things that we think are going to give the best return in the next year or so. But let's start with how the year's going so far, because actually you did your forecast, all of you, a couple of months ago now, so we've all got a bit of a chance to put you on the spot and see how things are going so far. Where should we start? Matt, why don't we start with you? How well are your forecasts standing up to the test of time so far?
Not as well as I might have hoped, I think, to be honest, Guy. I certainly, at the back end of last year when I put it together, I think my sort of strap line was it's going to be the best year to buy commercial property for a decade. And I can't really say that investors have leapt back into the market. And if you take a very generous look at my market investment volumes, I'd say, you know, it is a little bit up year on year at the sort of end of February. But unfortunately for my job security, an awful lot of that comes from Lucien's side of the table, a lot of residential investment buoying those numbers up. So I think we're slightly caught by the fact that, you know, people are waiting for things to happen, be it the general election, be it the first cut in interest rates. And there's a lot of good reasons to do nothing.
Yeah, well, we'll get into why you were saying it was going to be such a good year in a couple of minutes. Lucien, Matt says that a lot of the activity is coming from your side. Have you been proved right so far? I mean, it's early days. It is only March, right? But have you been proved right so far?
Yeah, so I'd say most of the stuff that we said would happen this year has happened more quickly than we anticipated. So we expected to see rents in the residential sector hit a bit of an affordability ceiling, and there's more evidence that that will be the case and that rental growth is slowing. And we also felt that at some point over the year, Given the prospect of interest rate cuts, we would see the residential property market bottom out and a return to price growth. And there's also a little bit of evidence that that has happened a bit more earlier. And I think that really is a reflection of the extent to which the mortgage markets have repaired more quickly than we anticipated. It's been a very competitive mortgage market, a slightly smaller pie, but each of the lenders trying to take a bigger slice of it. That's brought fixed rate mortgage costs down, a bit more stability in those, and that's fed through into the market a bit more quickly, I think, than any of us would have anticipated.
Brilliant. So we'll delve more into the detail of that in a minute as well. And Kelly, your predecessor and anyone I talk to in the rural team, I always sort of talk about your market being a more long term, and things happen slightly less quickly than in other markets. So you're probably, I'm guessing, sort of on track, are you? Because there hasn't been time for it to go better or worse than you thought it would.
Yeah, certainly when we want to look at land values going forward, it's looking at it over that long-term period. So we tend to say that land looks to ride the volatility roller coaster that some of the other asset classes endure. But certainly if we look at the two metrics that we reported on in our cross-sector, so one was land supply, so land coming to the market, and the other one was land values. And where we are coming to the end of quarter one, we're probably seeing a little bit of an upturn in land being supplied to the market in comparison to the first quarter of 2023. In terms of land values, they've probably stood on from the back end of 2023. So the final quarter of 2023, those land values have stood on into the first quarter of 2024.
Right, so let's get into the weeds then of the predictions. Matt, we'll start with you. You said a minute ago that you were predicting 3 months ago or whatever this was going to be one of the best years for a long time. Why do you? I mean, it may still be, right? So why? What made you think that?
Well, I guess what goes down must go up, or vice versa. If you're talking about yields, Kelly said, rural doesn't ride the volatility roller coaster. Commercial loves the volatility roller coaster. We're literally, down the first hill with our hands in the air going woo at the moment. And it's just a question of how many more bumps and high G turns they're going to be. But commercial property values have fallen by 25-30%. On average, and it's not difficult to find significantly larger falls off peak. Because the majority of those falls was really down to the rising interest rate, I think it is reasonable to assume that when interest rates come down, and we as a house think they will, commercial property values must rise. And again, it's a sentiment-driven industry, and I think we really are just waiting for the bottom feeders to come back in. There are two types of investors in my market, really. There are those who buy structural trends, and there are those who just play the cycle, because nothing is more true than the fact that commercial property is incredibly volatile. And the people who make the most money are the people who buy at the bottom and sell at the top. And we really are in that moment at the moment.
Is it automatically as general as that they're buying or selling the market? Does there come a point where they say, well, actually, if we like stock pick effectively, but in property terms?
You can tell you've been doing property podcasts for a long time. Yes, obviously, it is a lot more complicated than that. And I think generally, downturns in my market are relatively synchronous. Upturns are relatively asynchronous, and it really, the pace and timing of that upturn depends entirely on the sector, the subsector, the asset itself. Has it got rental growth prospects? And, we're very much in that sort of back to basic stock picking mentality, which is, ultimately, is it a building that tenants want to be in and want to stay in? It keeping it pretty simple here, but that is what drives out performance.
Yeah. So let's take a quick look at some of the areas that you did pick out. I think you said something about the best of retail is an option, you think?
Retail's definitely recovering, really, because it went down a long time before as a sector. It went down before COVID. It was the shock of the internet shopping. So you'd expect it to start recovering. So if you looked at vacancy rates on Oxford Street and Bond Street, they're coming down very, very quickly indeed. Retailers are looking at, they've had substantial cuts to their rents bills and rates bills, and suddenly towns and high streets and shops that weren't economically viable are, so they're opening new stores. And I think, you know, again, the macroeconomic view is for consumers to actually start to feel a little bit wealthier over the next few years. And let's not forget, we've been through a huge contraction of sort of household finances. Other sectors, I think, you know, look interesting. You know, I think offices are really interesting. You know, we probably didn't last
it's
time we met.
Is interesting a euphemism there, Matt?
No, it's not. It's not a curse. You know, I like a sector that everyone doesn't like because I think it offers the biggest roller coaster moment. And we wasted probably the last 2 or 3 years talking and chatting about the return to work and why do people work, where do they work. All of our data suggests that actually the hit of post-COVID agile working to offices has been relatively minimal. It's been negative, but it's probably not a bad thing. And actually there's such a shortage because development is so hard across all of our sectors. There's such a shortage of good quality space. Rents are going up and rents have been rising steadily for the last 4 or 5 years, and we think they will.
Yeah. So we'll come back to you for your top picks a little bit later on. But Kelly, let's head out of the city and on into the green pastures and talk a bit more about the rural area. So you were saying that you expected that the values would go up a bit and the supply of land coming to the market would go up a bit, and both of those things are happening. Why do you think that is?
It's been really interesting. 2023 saw land supply hit a 10-year average at 157,000 acres, but it's well short of what we saw in the sort of 60s, 70s, where we saw hundreds of thousands of acres of land being brought to the market. So we've seen sort of that steady decline. But as I say, we've seen in 2023 top the 10-year average, and it's been the highest since Brexit as well, and the agricultural transition, which is really encouraging. There's lots of reasons for that. So agriculture at the moment is going through a challenging time, but yet that really does provide those opportunities. So we've got agricultural transition, where that support is really transitioning in all devolved nations at a different pace and in a different way as well. So we know in England, really, the focus is a bit like a pendulum swinging. And it was certainly quite a hard pendulum being swung when we started our conversations back in November, December, from support for food production to that public money for public goods. What's been really interesting, I think, over the last few months is how the conversation has certainly changed, and certainly the direction from Prime Minister and from government is looking at food production and using the word public good when looking at food itself. And that's always been a really grey area. Has food been a private good or has it been a public good? So I think that terminology change, that shift in looking at what really is the important areas, is really important looking at the rural sector going forward. And there's those other, I talk about competing land uses, but actually it's those integrated land uses. So we look at forestry, we look at renewables, we look at development. You know, there's loads of areas, plus those emerging nature markets. So there's a lot of targets being set to support the environment, whether that's meeting net zero targets or 30 by 30, so protecting 30% of land and sea by 2030. There's so much to talk about, but there's so many opportunities for land as well.
Do you think that sort of understanding of land value in terms of sustainability and the lichen forestry and peat bogs and everything is maturing nicely or not?
I think we're really still at our infancy of understanding the opportunities and the land value aspect to that. And certainly just recently we've had the announcement through the budget of the tax implications for land going into environmental schemes. So, you know, we were wondering what would happen to that land, how it would be treated for tax purposes. But we have got some confirmation at least on some of those merits as well, which is much needed for landowners to be able to make those decisions. Some of these agreements for those emerging nature markets are long term. So if we look at biodiversity net gain, for example, they're 30-year agreements. If we look at nutrient neutrality, they're 125-year agreements. So you're asking for long-term land use change where we potentially don't really fully understand all of the impacts and the implications of that change.
Yeah. So, Lucien, so I sort of got the sense that you were quite pleased, actually, when you said that your predictions were not only coming true, but coming true a bit faster than you thought. So is it all about mortgages, do you think? Is it all about mortgage rates, or are there other factors in there as well?
Well, certainly mortgage rates and underlying bank base rate are the thing that will overwhelmingly dictate what happens in the housing market. But it's not just about that. Actually, a lot of it is around the prospect of a general election coming, both in terms of the fact that that might just have a dampening impact on demand in the second half of the year. That's normally what happens. I don't think it will be necessarily that significant, but you still could see some of that. But it's also about some of the policy changes and regulatory changes that we have seen in housing pretty widely. So in the private rented sector, we've got a renters reform bill, which will do away with the assured short-hold tenancy agreement, very, very slowly working its way through Parliament. Landlords are going to have to get used to operating in a different environment. That's, if you like, changing the profile of landlords. So that market becoming much more weighted to larger, wealthier landlords who are more able to deal with the risks associated with a more regulated environment. But it's also affected house building and housing delivery. Housing delivery essentially now falling. You've had a lot of changes in planning policy. Much more difficult to get a planning consent on greenfield land and urban extensions. And that really creating quite an uncertain environment for a lot of the house builders to bring forward new supply. And of course, they've had to also deal with things like the loss of Help to Buy, changing market conditions. There's probably just a little bit more optimism there at the moment because they've benefited a bit from the pickup in housing market activity of late, but still a pretty difficult environment for the house builders and the developers as things stand.
So let's talk about the election, because obviously there's one coming, the very latest, the very beginning of next year. I think it's probably likely to be October this year at the moment, judging by the talk that's going on. I mean, you've mentioned it, Lucien, from your point of view. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, all those changes that you're talking about that have happened recently, particularly around planning and things like that, which have been driven by a particular type of political policy. Everyone's having to deal with all of that, and yet knowing that then we're going to throw all that out later this year, and we're going to start again. For all of you, how much of an issue is the uncertainty that this particular election is bringing?
For me, I guess I slightly sit back smugly when Kelly and Lucien worry about policies, because politicians never really get that interested in commercial property. And I'm very grateful they don't, because meddling can be a problem, as we've heard, and sudden changes of policy. But macroeconomic impact is obviously hugely important. And, you know, if we have a very different taxation regime or a very different focus, it will mean different things for businesses in the UK and consumers in the UK, and different behaviour. So it's something I pay attention to, but actually not particularly worried about moving from one fairly centrist government to another. The fundamental problems are within the UK economy, and I suspect the solutions will be the same regardless of which party won the election anyway.
For the rural sector, it certainly has a significant impact, or could have potentially a significant impact, for all of the reasons that Lucien has highlighted. So if you look at just one of those areas, the Renters Reform Bill, that has a massive impact potentially on the rural sector and thriving rural communities, and the impact that that potentially could have. So just taking one element there, we could see how it could have an impact and how policy really does, you know, really drive the situation. And I think in terms of food itself, we've seen, you know, a government really struggling to grapple with what does that actually mean for the UK in terms of food security, self-sufficiency. We've got the PM who said that we would have a food security index reported on annually, and that would be in statute. So we're awaiting for that to happen as well. But how does another government take that forward? We have been told from all of the parties that food would be part, you know, of their agenda and be integrated with those environmental targets, but who knows? So we certainly do await more news, but it could have a significant impact, and especially on the fiscal policy change as well, on taxation, as you know, sort of Matt highlighted there, that could have a big impact for the rural sector on agricultural property relief, inheritance tax. So we await news from that.
So I think, interestingly, sort of Matt picked up the point that we're moving from one centrist government, or the prospect is we'll move from one centrist government to another centrist government. And I think you can understand then for Matt's sector how that's not necessarily a significant event in the way that it is in housing, because in housing there is a pretty clear divide between the two political parties. The Labour Party have seen an opportunity to assume the mantle of house building, a less restrictive planning policy, one which is probably more pro-development, with a view to increasing housing supply to get to grips with the housing crisis that we face. Clearly, the emphasis that they will then place on housing delivery, assuming they get in, the odds are that they will, as we sit here today, they've got a fairly significant lead in the polls. But the emphasis will change, clearly more of an emphasis on affordable housing. But they've also, I think, sort of slightly spotted the opportunity to put themselves forward as the party of home ownership, as well as the party of affordable housing provision. You know, what will that mean for the industry? I think it reflects one of the top picks that we've made. So one of the top picks that we've made in the development sphere is about partnerships with an affordable twist. It's about the house builders aligning themselves with those people who will provide affordable housing, which allows them to deliver more housing into that sector where there's going to be more government support. And that's really them flexing their business models just to change the political emphasis.
But it all injects a layer of uncertainty into what is relatively low transaction environment for us all. And it's really the last thing we need is people coming up with reasons not to make a decision. But in an election year, it is a very good reason not to make a decision. As we all know, they only tell us in the campaign period the nice things they're going to do. They don't tell us what they might do once they're in power.
Yeah. So look, time is flying, I notice. So let's do a quick fire version of your top picks. We'll start with you, Lucien, because you've done one already. The partnerships thing you just mentioned. Two more. What are your two top picks?
So for owner occupiers, given where we are in the cycle, sort of pushing into the recovery phase, it is about the opportunity to buy best in class. You can buy that in a less competitive environment. The performance of those properties always holds up much better than other parts of the residential property market. So I think there's a fantastic opportunity if you've got the funding behind you to go and to buy best in class. The other one that we picked actually is retirement renting. So we have this situation where we're increasingly older population, often under-occupying what were previous family homes. That means that the way that we occupy our housing stock is less, increasingly less efficient. There is a great opportunity to provide good quality rental accommodation for those in retirement ages, where there is undoubtedly a need, but equally where that sort of, if you like, unlocks some of the logjam that we have within the wider housing market.
Kelly, a couple of thank you, Lucy, by the way. A couple of top picks from you.
Yes, I had two top picks. And I think before I start going through them, it was just a point to say that we talk about all of these integrated needs and the demands that are being placed on land. And just a really fun fact that, you know, in order to meet all of our environmental targets alone, we would need an additional 10.8 million acres of land, which is an area twice the size of Wales. So I think it's important to keep that actually, in order to move forward and in order to create a resilient and sustainable rural sector, we need to look at how we can stack and bundle and sequence the options and the opportunities that are available to us. So my first top pick was still looking at grade 3 arable land and looking at the different variety of options that are available to that land. So we can be used for food production, but we can also use that to look at those emerging nature markets that and those targets that we need to meet. And then my second top pick was looking at prime arable land. So really focusing on that food production, but land with a resilient access and supply of water. So water really is challenged as we move forward for all sectors. But for the non-public water supply, if we do nothing between now in 2050, we'd need an additional 1,300 million litres of water a day. So really looking at how we can build that resilient water supply into our food production systems.
Wow. Yeah. We're going to come to tell me something I don't know in a moment, but there's lots of it. It feels like we've already done it. Matt.
Two cracking stats.
I know. Matt, what are your top
For me, slightly about playing the roller coaster. there is an opportunity at the moment to buy core commercial property at value add prices. So why wouldn't you do it? And you may, if you're buying beds, meds and sheds or logistics, life sciences and living, you can probably sell that in 2 years' time to the institutional market who really want that stuff but haven't quite woken up. So classic cyclical plays. Structural for me, food stores, I think growing population, echoing some of Kelly's points, look a good place to be. And I think, you know, the rise of AI means that, you know, data center growth is going to be even more aggressive than we expected it to be.
So that just leaves us with tell me something I don't know. I think it was a Savile standout stat when you two were last in the studio, but it's evolved into tell me something I don't know. So a little nugget of information that I thought very much like Kelly's come up with about 10 in the last 2 minutes. But where should we start? I'm going to leave you to last, Kelly, because you're obviously a mistress of this. So, Matt, why don't you go first? Tell me something. Tell us something we don't know.
I think because I really have ridden the roller coaster throughout this whole podcast, I've got to stick with that theme. So if you look at the last three recovery phases out of a crisis for commercial property, on average, prime yields have fallen by nearly 190 basis points over the first 12 months of that recovery. So when it comes fast.
Yeah. Lucian.
Well, look, it's an election year, so let's look at prime ministers. We've had a few lately. We've churned through them. The two longest-serving prime ministers in recent memory were Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair. Both of them saw a period of very strong real house price growth. Of the two, the one that saw the strongest house price growth and probably therefore changed the face of the housing market the most was actually Tony Blair.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Kelly, I mean, you've been deluging us with things we don't know already, but tell us another thing we don't already know.
Well, I'm going to stick with water and water scarcity and water resources and say that if we do nothing between now and 2050 for drinking water, we're going to be short of 3,435 million litres of water per day, which is equivalent to 1,375 Olympic-sized swimming pools per day.
Oh, my word. Right. Well, listen, that's a sort of wonderful in a way, but rather depressing note on which to end this episode of Real Estate Insights. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming back. And Kelly, thank you so much for being here for the first time. I hope it won't be the last. I'm sure it won't be the last. If all that's done is whet your appetite for more information, you'll find plenty in the UK cross-sector Outlook Spotlight Report, which you can find on the research section of the Savills website, savills.co.uk/research. That's it for this episode of Real Estate Insights. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you next time.
This podcast is for general information only and should not be considered professional advice. Savills accepts no liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss arising from the use of, reference to, or reliance on this podcast or its content. Savills makes no warranty as to the accuracy of the information in this podcast. This podcast and all copyright in this podcast is the property of Savills, and it shall not be used, reproduced, or quoted in whole or in part without Savills' prior written consent.